Oregon State Federal Affairs Order, June 27th, 2005. And we'll open a public hearing only for now on Senate Bill 424.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 424A comes to you from the Senate Rules Committee. This is a bill that has to do with Family Abuse Prevention Act, or FAPA, orders, commonly referred to as domestic violence restraining orders. The current law is that the court is required to give temporary custody of the children of the petitioner when granting a FAPA order to the petitioner unless the petitioner specifically requests that custody be granted to the respondent. This bill would allow the court to hold a hearing if the court believes that exceptional circumstances affecting the child's safety or welfare are present and that a different award of custody might be in order. It also requires the state court administrator to track the number of such hearings and to provide training to court officials with respect to these sorts of hearings. There are no amendments before you.
Okay. F. Sybil Hebb. Lisa, is it Sublick? Sublick? And then Dale Cox, Judge. Please just identify yourselves and start whichever order you prefer.
Thank you very much. My name is Sybil Hebb, Director of Legislative Advocacy for the Oregon Law Center, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to have a hearing today. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 424. I'll take just a few moments to explain the bill. I have only a few things to add to counsel's very competent summary. The Law Center is joined in support for the bill by the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence and by the Oregon Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And we worked together with the Judicial Department, with Melissa Seidlick from the Judicial Department, to come up with the amendments to this bill, which are before you today. They accomplish a small but very significant change in the way that judges will be able to implement custody orders under the Restraining Order Abuse Prevention Act. The bill is a good compromise between all of the parties, and it is an important bill to the proponents and will allow the system to better address the needs of the parties before it. Currently, the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which is known as FAPA, is one of the most, it's the single most important piece of legislation to victims of domestic violence here in Oregon. It provides immediate protection on a temporary basis to people who are being abused at home and who are in danger of further abuse. And this is a provision which is, of course, very important to the safety of individuals and also to the safety of their children. And it's an important safety tool for our communities as well. The current provisions of the law, as counsel stated, provide that when a person is before the court and is found to have been a victim of domestic violence, then the court is required in making a temporary custody order to provide that custody go to the person who is the victim as opposed to the person who is the abuser, who the court has found to be the abuser. And this is an important public policy position that reflects the fact that children deserve to be safe and free from abuse. This public policy is also implemented in Oregon's other domestic relations laws and in the presumption under ORS 107.135 that allows or guides courts in making permanent custody decisions. In this restraining order provision, there are circumstances, though we think that the current law is a good public policy statement in support of providing safety, there are certain circumstances in which the current law does not meet the needs of the parties or the children. And this bill will modify the law so that in extraordinary circumstances, the court may make a custody determination other than to the petitioner. And the bill will allow the court in extraordinary circumstances to enter a temporary provision that's appropriate for the safety of the parties and the children, pending a further hearing whereby the court can further investigate the facts and hear from both parties and make a determination that better meets the court's needs and the parties' needs. All of the parties involved in drafting this legislation recognize that in most circumstances the current law meets the needs of the parties and children. But they all also recognize that in a small percentage of the cases, the current law is not satisfactory. And for these reasons, we would appreciate and urge the committee's support of this bill. Some of the key strengths of the bill are that the current custody provisions are maintained for the usual circumstances, that the court is provided with some leeway to alternatively address unusual circumstances or exceptional circumstances, and the court is provided the means by which to gather more information before making a temporary order. The bill addresses the fact that this is an important step. It's a new step. It's a deviation from the way the law has been in operation for the past 25 years. And so it's important for us to track this and discover how we think it's working, whether we think it's meeting the needs that we have identified. And so to address that circumstance, the bill provides that the Judicial Department, or the State Court Administrator's Office, will provide education materials and training to be available for all the parties using this law, and also will provide that the court track the cases in which this exceptional circumstance provision is exercised so that we can look at those cases and follow up to see whether we do in fact think that this this change is meeting the need. There's just one other sort of technical amendment that I want to bring the committee's attention to. Currently, across the state, there is a variety of practice in determining how a custody or parenting time order that's entered as part of a restraining order interacts with a previously entered divorce, for example, or separation domestic relations order. And so there is some confusion amongst parties and attorneys in determining how that situation will be handled. And this bill will provide some welcome clarity as to how that will be handled. It provides that restraining order custody and parenting time provisions can, in fact, modify a previously entered domestic relations order, but only if to do so would be is necessary to address the safety needs of the parties or the children. And so it provides clarity for all involved, and we appreciate the committee's support. We would appreciate the committee's support of that change as well. Again, I very much appreciate your time and your attention to this matter, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, let's go ahead and have the other two testify before we have the questions.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Dale Kosh, and I'm a judge up in Multnomah County, Oregon, and presently I'm the presiding judge there, and prior to that sat in the family court for a little over 9 years. And up there we issue about 3,000 of these Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining orders each year. And for most, the current law is not a problem, but there has been an ongoing problem in the occasional case with the mandatory custody requirements, and the judges have been seeking a change in that requirement for some time, and we've worked out at this point, I think, a compromise that really does address the needs of both the victim advocates and the community they represent and the courts, and that's why I'm here to speak in favor of this bill today. Let me just give you kind of the practical problems that that we see right now with the present bill, present mandatory custody statute. And that is that if somebody comes in and has a basis for obtaining a Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order, then we're mandated to give custody to that petitioner of a child, regardless of whether that child is living with the petitioner, and in some cases regardless of whether the child has ever lived with the petitioner. That's not the case if there's an existing custody order in place, but there many times is not when somebody comes in to seek a restraining order. So we can run into situations where someone comes in, they have prior convictions for felonies, they have prior convictions for domestic violence cases, but in this particular case, they show up on our doorstep, there are no existing orders out there at that time. They show up with an injury on them and these are ex parte proceedings. In other words, we're only hearing from one side at the time that they're coming in and seeking that order. And they're in a situation where there's a basis for granting them a restraining order, and they are at the same time seeking custody. And if there's not an existing custody order in place, even if they're not physically If that child is not physically living with them, we're mandated to do that under the current statute. That's the type of extraordinary situation that we're trying to address in the statute. So we don't have to do that. So we can make temporary provisions to cover that 14-day period of time until there's a hearing. In a situation like that, the temporary provisions would in all likelihood be that the child remain with the respondent until we have an opportunity to hear from both of them and determine what's going to be in the child's best interest. This allows us in that kind of situation to really look at what's in the child's best interest rather than what's mandated. So that's the reason I'm here speaking on behalf of this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I am Belissa Seidlick, Family Law Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Judicial Department. As Ms. Hebb stated, Senate Bill 424, the A engrossed version, represents a compromise between the introduced bill, which would have given full discretion to judges in these types of proceedings, and those with concern about the inappropriate exercise of that discretion in some instances. And as Judge Koch definitely described the most egregious cases that come before the court, Senate Bill 424A engrossed would assist the judges in addressing those, particularly those where the petitioner is actually the abuser themselves or not the primary caretaker of the children and someone who is just simply seeking a tactical advantage against the other party. The department does not take an official position, is neutral on the bill, but I think it would be fair to say that most of the judges would see this as an improvement to the existing law, which does not allow any discretion at all. And I'll close my remarks. Take any questions.
Committee members, have any questions? Well, you've explained yourselves too well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 424 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 591. Senator Pavaski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 591 is a technical fix to a bill or a law that passed this last session regarding greater safety for pedestrians crossing in crosswalks. The municipal court in Florence actually had interpreted the law that was passed in 2003 to read that each lane, bike lane, parking lane, to be separate lanes from the travel lane. And because of that, there was not violations that were occurring as the police had interpreted. What this bill will do will make clear that those lanes, the bike lane or parking lane, would be considered the same as the travel lane. The reason for that is to ensure that an individual who is in the crosswalk would have a greater distance between them and the vehicle that may be wanting to pass through that crosswalk. This, we believe, gives clarity to the intent of what the legislation was providing for back in 2003, and that's the reason for the modification in the language that you have before you.
Questions?
I do, Mr. Chair. Senator Przanski, I'm trying to visualize just how this works. The stop and stay stop bill that we passed last session, sort of the classic cases where you have multiple, so say it's a four-lane roadway and you have a crosswalk that doesn't have a signal on it, and what it means is that when a vehicle is approaching and there's somebody in the lane they're in or an adjacent lane, they have to stop and remain stopped until the pedestrian clears that. Now, this appears to deal with a situation where there's a bicycle lane, say, between there's two lanes going together and they're in the same direction, and then there's a bicycle lane along the curb, and is it saying that when a pedestrian steps into that bicycle lane, they're not in a lane of traffic for that purpose?
No, they would be in the first travel lane. The concern is that the way the court has interpreted that, at least in that jurisdiction, that would be a separate lane, and you would count that as an individual lane of travel as compared to maintaining that from the curb until the inside of that travel lane for the vehicle would be all in one, with or without the bike lane. Basically, what we're attempting to do is not to have the bike lane or parking lane to be distinguished from the lane of travel.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, so the lane that of traffic that is right next to abuts the bicycle lane, they're all treated as one for that purpose.
That is correct.
So that would mean that if you had two lanes of auto traffic and then a bicycle lane beside it, it means that a car that's in the next over, say the left-hand lane of traffic, would have to stop and remain stopped while there was still a pedestrian in that bicycle lane.
As they were going exiting onto
exiting.
The curb. That's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah. Okay, I understand.
Senator, has anyone, for instance, specifically, Kevin Campbell or Mark Landauer contacted you regarding this bill and an amendment?
Mark Landauer, not regarding this particular bill. There was another bill that got hung up in the process that was a combination of multiple parts of it, and that one did not proceed because there was an attempt to, I think, by the city of Portland to try to shorten the distance to something in the range of 6 feet.
Yes.
And that got bogged down and didn't go anywhere. So what I did is I spoke with Representative Burley, Representative Gilman, as to this bill that had been incorporated. There was a belief on the part of the city of Portland by putting everything together, it may be a better package.
I told them I wouldn't, you know, entertain an amendment if you weren't on board. I don't like to do that to your bill.
So, yeah.
You know, I'd like you to talk to them. The thing that we saw in my discussion with them, so you're aware, like Court Street, when it hits commercial, where someone wants to turn right or left, those lanes are back clear into the other intersection. If there's people crossing the intersection or someone leaves the curb late, they get a yellow light before that lane is even moved. And so that's what we're starting to see on left and right-hand turns when you've got four lanes in one way or two.
Mm-hmm.
They've got some drawings that you might look at to see if, it, under limited circumstances, we might do something, but won't happen unless you want it to.
Mr. Chair, I'll be more than glad to meet with them. I assume based on I assume the House is at least on 24-hour or one-hour notice. That this could be scheduled pretty quickly. I'll be glad to meet with them at your request this afternoon and see if we can come up with something.
If you agree with what they're trying to do.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
If the chair is willing to entertain that, I'm more than willing to do that.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, and it may connect to that point there. The concern I think I was hearing about the implementation of this bill that we passed last time was that it would interfere with the flow of traffic that's turning in downtown Portland, where it's all signalized, and the idea that it was preventing cars from turning until pedestrians had completely cleared the area to the current lane and the adjacent lane. Now, it's always been my reading of the bill or the law that we enacted last time that it just has no applicability to a signalized intersection. Now, if there's a different thought, I mean, Senator Przanski, maybe you have a view on that. I realize it's a little different from the issue that's addressed in your bill, but my reading of the bill, or the law that we passed, is that in order to commit the violation under 811.0101A, it has to be where there is no traffic control device in place or in operation. So under that provision, it has no application in streets like downtown Portland where there are, you know, walk wait signs.
Senator Chair, Representative McPherson, that was my understanding, but again, the Chair has asked, I'll be more than glad to meet with them and make sure we have clarity on that, and if we are in agreement that something needs to be changed, we'll get that done immediately, and I will report back to the Chair as to whether or not we think there's an issue that can be solved. My only concern is that knowing what happened to the last vehicle that was being used for some of the changes that had been suggested, that there were members in the House that were concerned as to its application. So I want to make sure that the Chair is satisfied with it so this fix can be taken care of. And we may want to clarify the language based on Representative McPherson's statement as to making sure that it's understood that the bike lane or the parking lane would be considered part of that travel lane that's adjacent to it.
Yeah, what I would say, senators, I think this is a good bill, and we resolve this particular issue. Mm-hmm. The other issue is one I don't think really needs to be resolved. If
right.
we can fix it to somebody else's satisfaction at the same time, fine. But we don't have to do that, in my view, if it would prevent us from getting some this fix, which I think needs to be done.
I'll be more than glad to meet with them, and I'll report back to the chair and your committee administrator.
Senator, if you do meet with them this afternoon and they're around, you might give good Representative McPherson a call and see if he's available for a minute.
Okay. I'll do that.
I'd like to have a committee member there if you could.
That'd be wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further? Okay, thank you. We'll close a public hearing on Senate Bill 591. Open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 785.
Mr. Chair.
What do we got?
Oh, certainly. Senate Bill 785 establishes a plant pest and disease emergency response fund and provides for the continuous appropriation of monies from that fund to the Department of Agriculture for the purpose of responding to pest and disease emergencies to the extent necessary for the protection of the nursery industry. It allows the department to set an assessment rate on nursery industry licensees as necessary to maintain a balance of $250,000 in the fund. You should note, Mr. Chair, this you should have a fiscal impact statement in your packet, and this bill does have a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Budget.
Okay. Okay, Mark Simmons and Dan Hilburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Simmons. I am the Government Relations Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries, and we have collectively with the Department of Agriculture brought this bill before you. With the increased national and international traffic in plant material, plant goods, nursery products, we have a heightened risk of bringing new disease threats to Oregon that can undermine Oregon's nursery industry, its position in the marketplace today. It is the largest segment of agriculture in the state of Oregon today, nearly $800 million annual revenue, 21,000 employees, and just short of $300 million in payroll. And it's something that and we have a great interest in preserving for the future and seeing it grow. And this bill is our attempt to provide funding that would be available on an ongoing basis to enable the Department of Agriculture to react promptly to any new plant pest and disease threats that come on the horizon on short notice or otherwise and threaten the viability of the industry here in Oregon. And would very much appreciate your support.
Okay. Dan?
I'm Dan Hilburn. I'm Administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and we're fully supportive of this bill. We think it's a great idea. As Mark has mentioned, globalization in plant products has increased markedly just in the last decade, and along with it, there's a heightened risk of pests like sudden oak death, Asian longhorn beetle, emerald ash borer, that are very significant and killing plants, but perhaps more significant and causing quarantines. And a quarantine could have huge impact in a very short amount of time. So in order to respond to this heightened risk, we need the resources to jump on things more quickly than we have available now with federal funds or with e-board funds. So the nursery industry is being proactive here. They're asking you to allow them to collect resources from their own members to be put aside as an emergency fund so that when the next sudden oak death arrives, we'll be ready to jump on it quickly and be able to protect the markets for the industry. So we think it's a great idea and urge you to pass this bill.
Okay. Commanders, have any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 785 be referred to the Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bocas has moved Senate Bill 785 to the Budget Committee with a due pass. Any comments?
Mr. Chair, just a question. If this is all funded by out of the industry payments, what's the budget impact that maybe Adam didn't absorb what was going on here effectively, but is it just the sort of the administration of the fund? Is that the...
imagine that's what it is.
Yeah, well, why don't we get just an explanation
of
the record.
Do you have any comments?
The expenditure authority needs to be provided for in the ODA budget.
So it's treated as a budget item, even though it's... it's
funding source like fees and license, right, I believe, right, that come in, and you have to have the ability to expend those funds.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, that's fine.
Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 785 moves to do pass the budget committee.
I've already heard this.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 785 and we'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 786A.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 786A creates forest seedling grower cooperatives. It authorizes the Board of Forestry to enter into agreements with cooperative members for the production of non-industrial private forest seedlings. It exempts cooperatives and their members from antitrust laws. It establishes a regulatory program for cooperative members, imposes a surcharge on certain seedling transactions, and allows the monies from the surcharge and allocates that money to the Board of Forestry and the State Forester for carrying out the program. It also directs the State Forester to report to the Legislative Assembly regarding the program to an interim committee on natural resources by October 1st, 2008.
Looks like we've got the right people up here.
Mr. Chair, again, my name is Mark Simmons. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The bill that is before you is the result of emergency board direction to the department and other stakeholders who have interest in providing reforestation seedlings to family forest landowners. About 14 months ago, the e-board directed the department to work with stakeholders and see what could be done to provide alternatives to the D.L. Phipps nursery that the state operates in Elkton, Oregon. It provides permissive but non-prescriptive authority to allow the department to do just as the your able staff described, form a cooperative of seedling, private seedling growers who the state would then aggregate the demand for forest seedlings and allocate that demand across a cooperative of growers. It would also allow the state to lease the D.L. Phipps nursery to a private operator. It just provides some latitude. There's an ongoing discussion and several work groups continuing within the Department of Forestry. And as the obstacles get worked out, this legislation would allow the department to proceed without having to wait two more years till the next legislature convenes to act upon the direction that they've been given by the legislature.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. Mr. Simmons did an excellent job of describing the permissive authority this bill provides to the department. Our interest is in providing seedlings, not in running a nursery, and this allows us to explore the option of providing for a cooperative approach, providing seedlings through the Nursery Association and other nurserymen, as well as leasing the nursery. We think that that's an important opportunity to explore some more efficient and effective ways of providing seedlings, but it also provides an important safety net of allowing the nursery to be in operation or at least to be available to be used if these other approaches don't work out. We're supportive of the bill. I appreciate the work that Mark Simmons and other parties have worked on in terms of providing a bill that will meet the various interests of family forest landowners as well as providing some opportunity to do things more effectively and efficiently.
Committee members have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Gentlemen, I actually have been a long-time purchaser of seedlings from the Elkton Nursery for some family-owned forest land that we operate. And it's been a very useful source of material. Where is this bill taking us in terms of is the aim here eventually to transition out of the state, out of the nursery business, so that the private providers will fill that void? Is that what's contemplated, or is there contemplated there'll be some long-term kind of cooperative relationship between the Elkton facility and private providers?
I think both of your premises are correct. It opens the door to allow that debate to continue, and could result in private seedling growers filling the need that is currently being filled by the D.L. Phipps nursery. There is adequate capacity among private growers to do that today, but there is a great concern that the needs of the various stakeholders are provided for, that we maintain a stable long-term supply of seedlings. So it may be that after all the discussions and the work of the various task forces are completed, that the status quo would continue. But that's not a foregone conclusion, and this offers some additional options that would be legal courses of action available to the department to pursue.
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, members of the committee, if I may, I think that's a good description. I guess you said the department's interest is in providing seedlings to family forest lands. A little bit about that. Basically, we provide those seedlings based upon a speculative approach of looking at where harvesting is occurring and then growing on-demand seedlings, because family forest landers generally don't plan well, and they, after they harvest, they're looking for a supply of ready-made seedlings. But we have to grow those based upon both elevation and seedling zone standards. And so it's relatively high-risk approach that we've undertaken to provide that service to family forest landowners. Because of the kind of nursery we operate, we have limits in the technology we can apply in meeting that demand. And by looking at the alternatives, we believe it's very likely we can produce supply that can meet those demands better and through other technologies we can provide. So, you know, I think the interest of both the family forest landowners will be met, and we have a number of options to this approach, and I think by exploring them, it's just good government, and we plan on providing due diligence and certainly want to keep our options open by maintaining the nursery as a viable entity until we're certain this alternative or our alternatives will work.
I might just offer a comment, Mr. Chair, that the Elkton operation, in the experience of, that I've had and my family's had, has been a first-class operation to work with, and so I would urge the parties to make sure that we don't abandon or lose an important resource to family-owned timberland owners in the process of transitioning to more of a free market process here.
Well taken. I've, I think, on two or three occasions bought trees there. And there are some small family wood owners who do plan well.
There are. I wasn't Chair Krieger. I wasn't meaning to say that. That's always the case. But again, it is much more speculative in nature than what you might find from a more consistent manager. And if I may, I think the opportunity here really represents a win-win, and we do have a committee for family forest land owners that is a committee to the Board of Forestry that is watching and working with us very carefully, and they will be a key partner in making any decisions. So we are relying upon that committee as a key sounding board for this process.
Okay. Anything further?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 786 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 786A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections or discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 786A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Flores, would you carry, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are going to hold over today Senate Bill 1034. I believe we have some amendments coming. We'll open a public hearing only on Senate Bill 1047A.
Chair
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1047A comes to you from the Senate Rules Committee. This bill would provide local public safety coordinating councils, known as LPSCs, the authority to form multidisciplinary teams to review domestic violence fatalities and to make recommendations to local government to prevent such fatalities. Under the bill, the review team's role is not to investigate incidents, but rather to review facts and make recommendations. Those recommendations can be released by a two-thirds vote of the team. The membership of the team is outlined in the bill, and other members of the team may be added with the unanimous consent of the rest of the members. And by the same process, the rest of the members can identify the participation of those additional participants. The team's meetings are confidential and exempt from public records laws, and because of that, there is a portion of the bill that makes clear that any documents received by the team from other sources are not otherwise immune from discovery solely because they were received by the team. There are no amendments before you.
I'd like to have Civil Heaven come up again. Judge Coach and Connie, what's the last name? It's hard to read the last two sentences. We'll do it later. Okay, thank you.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, I'm again Dale Kosh, and the presiding judge up in Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1047. This bill partly grew out of a case we had up in Multnomah County, a domestic violence homicide, where we found that the person who had died had in fact had many contacts with the criminal justice system. And they were, at that time, in fact, pending cases in the system. And we decided that that was really the impetus to push us towards sitting down and trying to examine the circumstances surrounding that case and making a decision as actually as part of that process that we really, that couldn't just be a one-time event, that we needed to have a vehicle to continue to review cases in the future. One of the obligations we have as a justice system is to try to take any steps that we can to ensure that somebody, a victim of crime or a victim of domestic violence who is seeking out the assistance of the courts, isn't in fact worse off by having made that choice to approach the public safety system and in fact is more safe. So, what this bill does is allows us to set up a procedure, to have that procedure, have the information that's transmitted within the members of that team be confidential, and allows us the opportunity to try to continue to build a public safety response to domestic violence that actually improves the outcomes for people that approach the system through any way. And actually the other part of this is to also try to set up a system that encourages people who are victims of domestic violence to seek out the assistance of the justice system, because many people do not, who are victims right now. So I speak in support of this bill. Thank you.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, again, Civil Head with the Oregon Law Center, and again, I thank you for scheduling this bill for a hearing and for your time. As many of you know, the issue of domestic violence is a priority for the Oregon Law Center because so many of our clients suffer from this problem, and over the years of prioritizing services to this population, we have begun to understand how critical it is that the system response in our communities is coordinated and educated, and just how critical the response is to saving lives. And this bill is, as Judge Kosh mentioned, it grew out of a particular circumstance, but it's also reflective of a collaborative work between the Law Center as well as the District Attorney's Association and the Attorney General's Office and the Intimate Partner Violence Surveillance Project at the Health Department, as well as the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I believe you have letters of support support from those parties in your files, and representatives of those organizations are here in the audience today if you have questions for them. The bill, as Judge Kosh mentioned, provides confidentiality for these reviews, and that's an important element because without that, agencies are reluctant and unable to fully participate, and confidentiality provides the ability for there to be better sharing and more effective communication. The bill also provides a structure within which the reviews are to take place, and that structure is important because when we're looking at the results of these reviews and at the recommendations that come out of the reviews, it's important that we can rely on the consistency of the methods by which the reviews were conducted, and so that's the purpose of having the structure and the protocols for reviews. Just a couple of other points that I wanted to make, and one is that it's probably not necessary to make to this committee, but I just want to sort of provide as a basis a reflection on the fact that right now in Oregon, domestic violence is a critical public health and safety issue, and we have had some data from studies that were conducted between the years of 1997 and 2001, and during those years in Oregon, there were 18 to 22 deaths from domestic violence per year, and those deaths involved men, women, and children. So it affects us all. It affects our communities, and in fact, in that six-year period, 24 out of 36 Oregon counties suffered a domestic violence fatality. So it's something that we're seeing statewide as a problem, and this bill will help encourage people to get together to look at the facts to determine, was there something we could have done, or if we have these prevention efforts, how can we make sure that they're as effective as possible? Generally speaking, a fatality is the culmination of an increasing and escalating pattern of abuse. So in that period of time during which the abuse is escalating, is there something we can do? Is there something we can do better? And so this legislation really helps us to provide those effective reviews, and without it, without the structure, without the confidentiality protections, communities are hampered in their abilities to take a look at those cases. Just two other quick points. One is that the review teams, the bill provides that the review teams will collect data about the deaths in their communities and will forward that data to the State Department of Health. And that's an important criteria because this is a problem about which we know not enough. And the more we learn about the incidents across the state, the better we can implement both local and statewide prevention procedures. And the bottom line is that we think this will help provide safer communities, and we think that this effort is one small step that we can take to honor the tragedies that we have suffered thus far and to try to prevent future tragedies. So thank you.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Administrator of Crime Victims Assistance at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here in support of this bill in part as a result of my experience as the co-chair of the State Child Fatality Review Team back when that review process was initiated. As the co-chair, I had an opportunity to see the importance of these reviews in identifying issues that are relevant to the prevention of child abuse fatalities. For example, it was through our child fatality review process that we were able to recognize a growing problem with shaken baby syndrome. The result was to immediately begin a very proactive and very focused prevention strategy to make sure that parents with young children were aware of the dangers of shaking their infants. Domestic violence is, of course, not a cause of death, but rather it is a critical dynamic in Oregon's fatalities and many critical injuries to adults. The development of appropriate intervention and prevention requires that the professionals that are involved, court staff, service providers, and many others who come into contact with domestic violence victims have an opportunity to meet and discuss elements that may have surrounded a death. And with that discussion, what we can expect is more effective policy development, service prioritization where it's needed, better coordinated intervention, and certainly more effective prevention efforts. This bill does not mandate reviews, but it does make important legal provisions which will encourage these reviews. I encourage your support of Senate Bill 1047. Thank you very much.
Committee members, do you have any questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, only I guess a question about the scope of what is a domestic violence fatality. When I look at Section 1, particularly Sections 5 and 6, they seem the scope of them seems pretty broad. Maybe it doesn't make a lot of difference. Maybe you know what it is you're looking at, and I mean it's an important thing to be able to get sweep a fairly broad net and then know what it is you study and then focus your study in on what you're going to do. But it looks fairly attenuated when I look at Section 1, Sub 5. In fact, I'm not even sure exactly what events that is describing. And then Subsection 6, I see it's a person who's over the age of 18, not otherwise described in this section, and was the victim of a homicide relating to domestic violence. I don't find a definition of domestic violence for that purpose. Maybe I'm just missing it here. So I just throw that question out.
The bill does provide a link to the definition of domestic violence, so that is linked back to the term as it's defined in other provisions of the law currently. The sections, I think the purpose of the bill is actually to provide a fairly broad net so that we can look at this problem in a way that's encompassing and not too narrow. And each individual community, the bill provides that each local team will establish its own protocols by which it selects cases, and so those protocols are required to be written down and agreed to by all of the team members. So there could be some local sort of decision about the scope that an individual team will choose to move forward on. I don't know if Judge Crash, if you have anything to add.
I think Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative McPherson, I believe that subsection 5 deals with the situation that it's generally the current partner or spouse and of the, that's the victim. The perpetrator is the former spouse or
right
partner of that person, and the violence is not always directed towards the former partner, but sometimes towards the former partner's current relationship or, unfortunately, to other members of the former partner's family.
Yeah, it would seem to go to sort of the jealous triangle kind of situation.
Is correct. What's
getting at it, and that's fine. I don't have any concern about that. I guess that is a fairly broad net, but on the understanding that people will be trying to focus in on that which is real, truly domestic violence, I think that's what we need to be aiming the bill at.
Further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1047. Open the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1062A. Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I ran over here. We are kind of on a call, off a call, so I'll try to be brief. Senate Bill 1062 comes to you from the Rules Committee because, at my request, I asked the Senate to address this issue early in the session. I'm tired of being having these life experiences that have to create legislation, but Mr. Chair, it's kind of the way it worked out here. I was served with a public records request last October, November 1st, by a newspaper reporter. I had never been served with a public records request before. It was pretty sweeping and broad, and I knew nothing about the public records law. I was surprised to learn about things that I didn't even know we were supposed to be doing. For instance, there is an archiving law that after each session, we're supposed to give the legislative administrator any official record that I or my staff have made and no longer needs. I bet none of you have ever done that. Then there's the public records law that requires you to retain email and all sorts of things. Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know about you. I've been in the building since 1999, and I've never, ever received training on the public records law. So I was quite surprised when I got my opinion back from Legislative Council and we learned that there are holes in the law. That's why you see Senate Bill 1062. There is currently nothing in the record that gives an end date for how long records are to be kept by the legislature. There's no clear discussion about email. There's no clear discussion about telephone records and computer records. And, Mr. Chair, let me tell you something that really scared me when I found out about it, because it was time-consuming, not because Oregonians shouldn't know about it, but to have access to your phone records at home, your cell phone, and your district phone. If you make a state-related call on any telephone, could be your neighbor's telephone, that phone record is subject to a public records request. Of course, you can redact all phone calls that are not related to state business, and that was where I was having a lot of angst, because I work a regular job outside of this building, and trying to work a regular job and a state senate job and then being served with this very broad public records request was really causing a lot of problems. The records request ended up going away, and I was happy about that because I had spent many hours combing my emails trying to figure out what's discoverable and what isn't, because there are certain types of email that are exempt under the law. There are certain types of records that are exempt. So basically, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I came to the session, and the first week of session gave a presentation to my Senate colleagues and scared the wits out of them. We need to know. I should never have to have a newspaper reporter tell me that he is an expert in the public records law. We make the laws here. We should be an expert in those laws as well. So, Mr. Hendricks is here. He became involved in this issue after Mr. Chamoff left. And what you see before you is the law that we were able to craft that put some sideboards around what we should be doing as legislators. I have to tell you that some of my colleagues are so upset about this because, as you know, we get tons of mail every single day. We get so much email that it overburdens the system, and I'm constantly having Bud Richmond come down and expand my email capability. But there are parameters, and we just need to understand what they are. But some of my colleagues were being facetious, and they said, well, I'm going to start collecting all of my papers every day and take them down to Dave Henderson in legislative administration by the box load, and he can understand the volume of mail that we get in our inboxes, our email, and also by mail. So, you see, Mr. Chair, we can't exempt ourselves from the public records law. I don't believe that would be good policy, but we can certainly put some parameters around it. And Mr. Hendricks is here to talk to you about this bill in more detail.
Chief, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. The bill that you have in front of you would essentially do three things, and I should start by saying that legislators are subject to the public records law, and the public records law applies to all documents that relate to the conduct of the public's business, and it doesn't make any difference what form they're in, emails, etc. The one thing that that I've been emphasizing with members since this first came up was that there is some ability for legislators to make decisions about what they keep. There are a lot of concerns. Does this mean we have to keep every single email we get? Does this mean we have to keep every piece of paper that's handed to us? The public records law only applies to documents that are used and retained by the public official. And the public official has the ability at the time they get an email, or the staff person has the ability when they get an email to decide, is this something that I am going to use? Otherwise, if there was another rule used, what would happen would be someone could flood this building with material and you would be forced to keep it because you would suddenly become the custodian of these records. And so our advice has been that you do have that ability at the time you receive records about whether this is something you're going to use, things that you have not created, things that are coming to you from other people. Am I going to use this, retain this? If not, you know, you can discard it, and it does not, you do not have responsibility for it. The bill does three things. First, it fills in the biggest hole that exists right now for members of the Assembly, which is the lack of a retention period. a public records law doesn't have much significance if there isn't some requirement that you keep public records. So it provides a one-year retention period for those materials that you create or those materials that you keep and retain. The second thing it does is it allows you to deliver these records to the legislative administrator. In fact, it requires you to return it over to the legislative administrator within 60 days after you cease to be a member. So you can just turn those over to Dave Henderson. As a practical matter for those, the 1 year period was derived at because the thought was is that the end of each session, when the most records are generated, you'd be able to keep those until the beginning of next session, and when you came back next session, you could basically clear out your records in anticipation, your bill files and all those other things you used in the prior session, knowing that more than 1 year had passed since the first one was created. The final thing the bill did was to create, allow the Legislative Administration Committee to adopt exceptions to the retention period. That was to allow the Legislative Administration Committee to basically go in and take a look at this from time to time based on new developments in technology, et cetera, to make decisions about whether or not certain documents should be exempted or perhaps have certain records have longer periods of time for retention. There are a set of -A2 amendments that our office had prepared. The primary purpose with the A2 amendments as opposed to the original bill is to make it clearer what employees of members are covered by this one-year retention period. As originally drafted, the bill referred to employees, other employee caucus members, caucus employees, legislative assistants, and other persons employed to assist members of the Legislative Assembly. And there was concern that perhaps that would cover committee employees, which it was not, and legislative committee, standing committees, or statutory committee employees as well. The amendments make it clear who we're talking about, basically legislative assistants, persons employed to assist a single member of the assembly, people employed to assist the Senate president or the Speaker of the House, people employed to assist the majority or minority offices of the Senate or the House of Representatives. We would recommend that change. I think it makes it a lot clearer about these other people who are subject to it. And I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I didn't know you had the -2 amendments, and that comes from some discussion that we had on the Senate floor. There were some questions about that, so I'm glad to see you clarified that.
Are the -2s in the bill and it came over?
No. That's before you today.
The -2s are in your packet today.
And, Mr. Chair, I would state that one of the questions I asked on the floor, I needed to lay a pretty good basis for what we were doing, is I asked if we were still subject to the archive law, and that goes away with this bill. This now becomes our public records law. We don't have to do the archive law.
Had anyone ever complied with this? Do you have any legislators that this has been the law right along?
Chair Krieger, I suspect not. My feeling is you probably were never subject.
Are we all criminals?
Yes.
I'm not. I'm a friend.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are.
My information from Dave Henderson is that individual members have never, not one has ever turned over their records to him at the end of session. I don't think they were probably even subject to that provision. But what that left you with is a situation where you had, no retention period, but a law that said that you violated the law if you destroyed records.
See, Mr. Chair, how things just sort of fell in my lap. I mean, when this came up and I asked questions, Legislative Council was surprised as well. And we've had members resign. Senator Dukes left in January. I think her records have all been tossed. And we would toss ours when we're done, but we always toss them at the beginning of the session, and I think that's why Mr. Hendricks decided on the one-year period, because we don't have any, or you didn't do it, I'm sorry. That's why our committee decided on that, because we can't store all this stuff, and it's just used for creating these bill files. I would also like to state that not only and this you need to be aware of as well. Not only can your telephone, if you're using your telephone, any home telephone to conduct state business, if you're using your home computer, for state business. For instance, I have a personal email. I have people send things to that personal email account. Those emails are discoverable also under the public records law as long as they're dealing with state business. Now, there is an exemption for you if someone writes to you and expects confidentiality, because as you can imagine, Mr. Chair, last interim when I was working on some very sensitive subjects, I had people send me a lot of information that was considered confidential. And, in fact, I fought very hard for that reporter not to get that information, and it was already exempt under the law. And so we do have some protections, but just because you send it to your personal email account, it still is subject to the Freedom of Information Act or the public records law.
Okay. Representative Barker, you have a question?
What will happen if we don't pass this law?
You're a criminal, Mr. Chair, and Representative Barker.
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker. It would leave you with a lot of uncertainty about how long to retain records, because we have been unable to find any argument for including you under the archiving times that are provided by the state archivists for state agencies. And I did discuss this briefly with folks at the Attorney General's office, and they could not find a way to make that argument either. So right now, you're subject to the public records law, but there is no law that establishes or authorizes anybody to establish a retention period for those records.
Mr. Chair, if you have no more questions, I'm under a call.
Fine. I mean, we'll continue.
Okay,
Mr.
great.
Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Then do we've all violated the law, and this new law doesn't exempt us from what happened in the past.
Chair Krieger, that's correct. I think, though, that the odds of anybody facing a problem, with the exception of perhaps that very recent SAIF situation, and I don't even know if that has ever been considered a criminal offense. I'm not aware of anybody ever being charged with a criminal offense for destroying public records under a public records law. And in fact, looking at that criminal statute, it's a very old statute, and you can see what it was designed to really get at. It was designed to get at the person who would go into the deed office and try to alter or destroy a deed or something like that. It wasn't aimed at public records the way we think about public records now. It was aimed at those things that back then were in the deed office or recorded deeds. But it's a problem. It's a problem that's out there because of the way those statutes work together.
Any further questions? Representative McPherson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, it would seem to me that by passing this bill, what we would do then is to clarify that we're in violation when we don't retain for a year, whereas without a retention period set in the law now, that by implication, at least what I would infer from that silence, is that one retains the records for as long as they have relevance to one's work as a member of the Legislative Assembly, and that one would be free to discard them at whatever point they cease to seem useful. And well, I guess what I'm worried about here is we set a bright line that then is set at a year, and if we don't conform to that, then we're in violation, even if it's a fairly transitory kind of record. Reactions?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, there is there at least one statute for legislative records for certain committees that include the very rule that you just stated, that you could keep them for as long as you thought they were of value, and then you could get rid of them. It only applied to a few committees, including, I believe, legislative administration and ways and means. So there are, part of the problem is there are some statutes that spell this out for some committees, et cetera, but the trouble is members are never really mentioned or even discussed about what would happen with committee members. So part of the concern would be is having statutes there that say we know how to say how to do this, but then having complete silence for the member leaves you with that dilemma with what exactly the retention period is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm just curious, as the people who would be interested in the public records law, mainly the media, have they had anything to do with this at all yet? Have they seen this? I mean,
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker, this has primarily been a discussion with legislators at this point. We have not had a lot of, the people who are usually interested are, of course, the newspapers, news outlets. It does establish a clear rule for them as well about how long they can go back and look.
I'm a little surprised they haven't weighed in on it because they, I mean, essentially they wrote the public records, at least with regards to the press and what they can get. I mean, and what you can do, you know, to counter. But anyway, okay. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, just so that I'm clear, on the dash two amendments, it talks legislative record needs a measure or amendment thereto. So that would I understand to be bill files that each 90 of us in this building hold, and we are to deliver those to Mr. Henderson, our bill files. Volumes of bill files. What's the repository for all of those? His
Chair
office?
Krieger, Representative Florence. And mind you, you only need to deliver it to him if you're leaving office. Otherwise, you may deliver it to them if you wish. Otherwise, you can keep it and destroy it yourself, or keep it, depending on what you want to do after the one-year period runs.
Anything further?
I have a question.
There's a
bill question. To the bill file issue, Section 1, Subsection 1, says must be retained for 1 year after the records are created. We come back in the next session, the bill files will be older than a year. So would we deliver them to Mr. Downstairs and let you swamp and die in that, or would you throw them in the trash can because it's beyond a year?
Chair Krieger, Representative Boquist, again, if it's more than a year old, I don't see why there would be any need to deliver them to Mr. Okay. Henderson, because at that point, either you want to keep them or you don't, and there would not be much point in delivering to Mr. Henderson. The only time you have to deliver them to legislative administration is when the member leaves office, and at that point they need to indicate how long Mr. Henderson has to hold on to these things, and generally it's going to be probably hold on to them for 1 year from the time we deliver them, and then you'll be sure that everything in there has gone past the 1 year period.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying in farmer terms here is that we would deliver to Mr. Henderson any record we have that had been created in the previous year on our departure date. So our bill files wouldn't be that. It'd be something that we created hypothetically during the interim somewhere around January 1st of next year. Is that correct?
That, Representative Krieger, Representative Boquist, that's correct. Almost. Yeah, most of that stuff will certainly be gone in here. I would note, too, that this would be helpful probably as well for things like email records, which right now are also vague about how long you keep email records. This would make a clear, bright-line rule for those communications as well, and it's something also that can be worked out then with IS, Information Services, here in the building as far as deletion of email records.
Mr. Hendricks? They read Section 1, the first sentence. Then I go back to where Representative Flores was on the dash 2 amendments on the second page. It sounds like they're saying two different things.
I don't have the original bill. I just have the amendments. I'm looking at Section 1, Subsection 2. It says that records of members of the Legislative Assembly and legislative assistants that contain information relating to the conduct of the public's business must be retained for 1 year after the records are created. So that's all the same except for the addition of the words legislative assistants, and that was to get around the problems that were created by Subsection 4 of the original bill, which said the provisions of this section apply to these other employees as well. And questions in the Senate and questions that came up since the bill came through, it seemed like a good idea to describe exactly who these people were and just make that rule applicable to them put them up there in the sentence rather than relying on Subsection 4 to say, well, this applies to you as well.
Page 2. The amendment has no deadline.
Ask her about that.
Mr. Harrington, you said you have A2 in front of you, right? Can you show me in the A2 amendment where it says 1 year?
It's on line 11 of the A2
Got
amendments.
It. All right, my name's again.
Two.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Oh, I wasn't sure whether Representative Boquist was finished. Can I pursue this slide? Mr. Hendricks, it looks like to me as though under current law, we each make a decision on our own what we think the sort of relevance period is for records, and then we toss them in our own discretion. And what this will do is it will fix a bright line of 1 year during which we have to retain records, and probably isn't really going to get joined as an issue until people leave, at which point, under my reading of this bill, anything that is within a year old at that point has to be turned over to Mr. Henderson. That looks like that's the effect of what we're doing here, is we have an obligation to retain for a year, and we have to then, as we're leaving office, either at the end of our term or upon resignation earlier than the end of the term, we have 60 days in which to turn over anything that's within that one-year period over to legislative administration.
Representative Krieger, Representative McPherson, that's correct.
And I think the policy issue is whether that's a desirable clarification to fix a bright line standard or to leave it in the more discretionary zone that it is operating within now, I think, which is that each member decides on their own behalf what they think the period of relevance is for for a public record.
Just a second, I'm reading something. Anything further? Thank you. From polling the committee, it appears that there is some concern of where this bill is going and whether or not it's clear. So we're going to hold the bill over. We're not going to go in and move it for now. So we'll close the public hearing and the work session on Senate Bill 1062A. And we'll open a work session for possible consideration of House Bill 2147. The chair rests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 2147 be taken up immediately. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the vote by which House Bill 2147 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the vote by which the -8 amendments dated 6/22/05 was adopted be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The motion carries and the vote has been reconsidered. Could you give us an explanation of the amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
In your packet, you should have House Bill 2147-9 amendments dated today's date, 6/27/05. Excuse me. The dash 9 amendments replace the dash 8 that we passed out on the 22nd. These amendments were drafted at the request of the Department of Human Services and simply changed the date related to the refund of any assessments paid by waivered long-term care facilities and are needed to avoid any fiscal impact for before the implementation of this new legislation. The new language, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is on page 2, section 3C, lines 21 through 24 for the committees. You wanted to take a look at that.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, would you come up just a minute, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson representing Oregon Healthcare Association. Committee counsel is correct in that after these amendments were adopted and passed out of committee last week, I was contacted by the Department of Human Services and one of their attorneys looking at this after the fact wanted to make a date change in here related to the refunding of assessments. We would have otherwise run into a fiscal impact on it above and beyond what the budget chairs had agreed to, and so what you have before you in the dash nines primarily is some new language or some slightly different language in section 3B on page 2 and then a new section 3C.
The committee have any questions? Have a motion on the dash nines?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash nines be adopted.
Okay. Representative Barker has moved that we adopt the dash nines into House Bill 2147. Any objection? Not so ordered. Any motion on the bill?
I move House Bill 2147 to the floor with the due pass as amended.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2147 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Who's the carrier on the last night?
Flores. Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2147 is amended and moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Flores, you are the carrier. That was the dash nines.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're finished. Please adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you.